This is from a Xerox copy of a letter written to Bill Wilson by Ruth Hawk, dated November 10, 1955. Ruth Hawk was Bill's first secretary, who also worked with him in typing the big book. Across the top, in Bill's handwriting, it says, Ruth Hawk's Recollections. She writes, Dear Bill, as I wrote to you last week, it is difficult for me to get a long period of uninterrupted time together to put down my recollections of those old AA days. But I have about 2 hours, so here goes. Let me say first that I do not guarantee the accuracy of any dates I may use until I have the opportunity to check one thing against the other, which I am willing to do if it ever proves necessary. Neither do I insist that my memory is absolutely accurate, but it will be easier if I can just sort of meander along for present purposes. As I remember it, you had been sober just a little over a year when I first met you. I think I went to work for Honor Dealers in about January of 1936. The job I applied for was a secretary to sort of a distribution for a group of service stations. Naturally, I had no idea what a surprise fate had in store for me and what a change it would make in my personal life and my relations to and my opinions of my fellow man. I walked into the Honor Dealers office in Newark, New Jersey, on William Street one Monday morning, was interviewed by Hank, and started to work immediately that morning. My immediate impression of Hank was that he had a vibrant personality, that he was capable of strong likes and dislikes, that he seemed to be possessed of inexhaustible energy, and that he liked to make quick decisions. You arrived shortly thereafter, Bill, bringing with you an aura of quite warm friendliness, of slow, deliberate decisions, and at least I thought at the time, not much interest in really the service station business. By the end of that very first day, I was a very confused female, for, if I remember correctly, that first afternoon you had a visitor in your office, and I think it was Paul Kellogg. Anyway, the connecting door was left wide open, and instead of business phrases, what I heard was fragments of a discussion about drunken misery, a miserable wife, and what I thought was a very queer conclusion indeed, that being a drunk was a disease. I remember distinctly feeling that you were all rather hard-hearted because at some points there was roaring laughter about various drunken incidents. Fortunately, I liked you both immediately. I am not too easily frightened, and you were paying $3 more per week than I had been getting, so I was willing to give it a try. You will remember with me, I know, that in those days and for several years to come, we talked about drunks and non-alcoholics, and therefore I use those terms here. The activity of Honor Dealers, as I remember it, was never of paramount importance. It seemed to me that after I began to know most of you original men, that it was only a means to an end, that end being to help a bunch of nameless drunks. Having come from a thrifty German family, I know what I thought. If you two could spend as much energy and thought and enthusiasm on Honor Dealers as you did on drunks, you might actually get somewhere. That would be hard to prove either way. And actually, I've never known whether the original premise of Honor Dealers was sound. Anyway, I soon stopped caring whether Honor Dealers was successful or not, and became more and more interested in each new face that came along with the alcoholic problem, and caring very much whether they made the grade or not. All of you made me feel as though I were a very worthwhile person in my own right and very important to you, which in turn made me want to always give my best to all of you. To me, that is part of the secret of the success of AA, the generous giving of oneself to the needs of the other. Well, the activities of Honor Dealers slowly but surely declined, and there was more and more correspondence with drunks and more of them showing up in the office. In those days, it was part of the procedure. If the prospect was willing to go along, to kneel and pray together, all of you who happened to be there. To me, drunkenness and prayer were both very private activities, and I sure did consider all of you a very revolutionary lot. But such likable and interesting revolutionaries. Hank put a good bit of thought and effort into Honor Dealers. But whether his ideas had real merit, or whether there was enough prolonged effort, or whether it was just a poor time for that kind of an idea, I was not capable of judging then, nor am I now. I only know that within a year, finances were precarious enough to move us into a tiny office in the same building, and even then I was front man to explain to the superintendent why the rent wasn't paid on time, and the telephone bill, etc. Payday was an indefinite affair indeed. I am somewhat confused about the timing of the move into the small Newark office, because now that I think about it, I remember the bookwork was done in the large office. Anyway, early in my association with you, Bill, you began to dictate letters to Doc Smith. You never liked to dictate to the shorthand notebook. You always dictated directly as I typed. In the amazing way, these things often happen. Since word of what you fellows were doing in New York, and by the time Doc Smith and Akron was simply spread vocally from mouth to mouth, inquiries began to float in from amazing distances. And some of these you asked me to answer in my own fashion. That is, to refer them to the closest educated drunk. Educated, of course, in the sense that they knew something of this possibility of an answer to alcoholism. Somewhere during those first months, I also first met Doc Smith, who gave everyone a feeling of great serenity, peace with himself and God, and an abounding wish to share what he had found with others. Somewhere along in there, John Henry Fitzhugh Mayo also appeared. Offhand, I have no idea of the dates. With his warm sense of humor and all the abiding wish to give to other drunks what he too had found, this you all had in common to an exciting and unbelievable degree. During that first year, at least, I don't think I ever attended a meeting, but through your dictation, Bill, through all I heard at the office, and through the letters I was answering myself in your behalf, I began to observe an understanding of what it was all about and what you were trying to do, and I became aware that the possibilities of writing a book were being discussed. Many of you thought it was an absolute necessity, because even though the original idea was often distorted in the hundreds of word-by-mouth discussions, its original basic simplicity was often completely confused beyond comprehension. And besides, it was becoming more and more impossible to fully expound the idea satisfactorily in letter after letter to various inquirers. Also, especially to the advertising type of man, the spread of the idea was going much too slowly, and we'd become a sensation overnight if only put out in book form. So far as I know, there was never any doubt that you were the one to write it, Bill, and I know that you spent endless hours discussing its general form with everyone who would listen or offer an idea, especially with Doc Smith, Fitz, and Hank. As soon as you began to feel you had at least a majority agreement, you began to arrive at the office with those yellow scratch pad sheets I came to know so well. All you generally had on those yellow sheets were a few notes to guide you on a whole chapter. My understanding with this was that those notes were the result of long thought on your part after hours of discussion, pro and con with everyone who might be interested. That is the way I remember first seeing an outline of the 12 steps. As I look at it today, the basic idea of each chapter of the book and the 12 steps is still essentially today what you scribbled on those original yellow sheets. Of course, there were thousands of small changes and rewrites, constant cutting or adding or editing, but there are only two major changes made that I remember. Both fought out in the office when you and Hank and Fitz and I were present. The first had to do with how much God was going to be included in the book itself and the 12 steps. Fitz was going all the way with God. You were in the middle, Hank was for very little, and I, trying to reflect the reaction of the non-alcoholic, was very little too. The result of this was the phrase, God as you understand him, which I don't think ever had much of a negative reaction anywhere. We were unanimous that day, and you got a green light everywhere you showed that typewritten copy, including Doc Smith and the Akron contingent, where a copy of everything was sent for okay or criticism. The only other major change I remember during the actual writing of the book was that originally it was directly written to the prospective alcoholic. That is, you were wrong. You must. You should. And after a big hassle, This was changed to read, "We were wrong, we must, we should, etc." This was quite a job, because by the time this major revision was decided on, most of the book had been finished in its first draft, at least, and each chapter, as well as the 12 steps, had been slanted toward you instead of we to begin with. At this time, I had still attended very few meetings, but I know that the office confabs and final decisions were only made after the aforementioned hours of discussion with all who cared to take part in them with you, so that the majority opinion of all who attended meetings at that time was reflected in the final decisions. During all this time, of course, there were plenty of discussions about a name for the book, and there were probably hundreds of suggestions. However, I remember very few. 100 Men, The Empty Glass, The Dry Way, The Dry Life, Dry Frontiers, The Way Out. This was by far the most popular. Alcoholics Anonymous had been suggested and was used a lot among ourselves as a very amusing description of the group itself, but I don't believe it was seriously considered as a name for the book. More later on this. By the time the book was mimeographed, mostly for distribution and an effort to raise money to carry on and get the book published, there was constant discussion about detail changes, with seemingly little hope for unanimous agreement. So it was finally decided to offer the book to Tom Uzel for final editing. It had been agreed, for one thing, that the book, as written, was too long, but nobody could agree on where and how to cut it. At that point, it was still nameless, because Fitz had reported that the selected name of The Way Out was over-patented. I remember that during an appointment with Tom Uzel, we discussed the various name possibilities, and he, handwritten insert, Tom Uzel, immediately, very firmly, and very enthusiastically stated that Alcoholics Anonymous was a dead ringer, both from the sales point of view, because it was catchy, and because it really did describe the group to perfection. The more this name was studied from this point of view, the more everybody agreed, and so it was decided. Uzel cut the book by at least a third, as I remember it, and in my opinion did a wonderful job on sharpening up the context without losing anything at all of what you were trying to say, Bill, and the way you said it. I really cannot remember who originally thought up the name Alcoholics Anonymous. Handwritten insert, which appears to read Joe Warden, and a reference to a handwritten footnote, which appears to read Joe Warden, an AA member who just couldn't stay sober. It does not look like Bill's handwriting. The financing of the book is quite difficult for me to remember. That is, what happened when. Originally, of course, the work was done on honor deal time. In other words, what salaries were paid came from honor dealer transactions, and the paper, the pencils, the office, the typewriter, the phone, etc., belonged to honor deals. Let me make it clear that the members of honor dealers were never cheated in any way. They were always promptly served. It's only that what might have been a worthwhile idea for a group of service stations just didn't pan out. When the income from honor dealers finally dwindled away completely, finances were a real problem. At this point, there was universal agreement, except in Cleveland, that the book was a necessity and that what you had done on it up to that time was extremely satisfactory, both in concept and execution. So the only problem was how to get enough money to finish it and get it published. You went to one of the large book publishers about an advance, and as I remember it, you were offered $1,000 with a rather minute royalty on each book published. Hank, I think, then came up with the idea of selling stock to finance the writing of the book and to publish it. Thus, Works Publishing Company was born, and the book stock idea set up and forms printed. There was great optimism about the ease with which this stock could be sold by you and Hank and Wally Von Arx, who was active in this phase of the situation. That dream was not to be fulfilled, because for the most part, selling a share of Works Publishing Company stock for $25 was like pulling teeth. Enough stock was sold in the original enthusiastic reaction of a few to keep us going on an extremely minimum basis for a while. And then sales came to a complete halt. There we were, back where we started. The paradox of this is the fact that if enough stock had been sold, and the book carried through to a conclusion on this basis, the stockholders would have had a fine return indeed for their original investment. However, all things happen for the best, and this kind of private profit would probably have been a perpetual thorn in the AA side. You then decided to approach Mr. Rockefeller, and were able to do so through various contacts you had built up through the years. This resulted in the Rockefeller dinner, which in turn resulted in a minimum pledge, which finally resulted in the book being carried to a conclusion and finally published by the Cornwall Press. Fortunately, I am not very good at getting across the spirit of fun, the real enjoyment of life, the cheerful acceptance of temporary defeat, the will to keep trying, the eternal effort to keep everybody satisfied, which made these years so worthwhile and so soul-satisfying. In this paragraph, I am describing particularly my own reactions, but I know that you will agree, and so would everyone else who had any share of it. Even the altercations and disagreements, of which there were many, were carried on with a basic will to reach a compromise at least. Therefore, a compromise was always possible and always reached amicably. Naturally, when the book was finally rolling off the press, the feeling was that our troubles were over, which turned out to be far from the case. It was agreed that the book needed to be advertised, and a date was finagled for a member of AA on We the People. Morgan Ryan agreed to pair unanimously and did a good job with his 3 minutes while we all listened breathlessly on the radio. As I remember in it, his talk was slanted at doctors, and to back him up, we had mailed out thousands of postal cards to a selected list of doctors to reach them in time, to get them to listen to the broadcast, and to tell them how to get a copy of the book. We had an assembly line all ready to pack and mail the books when the orders came rolling in, and then we waited. I don't think that more than 4 cards were returned at all, and the only one that made an impression on me was the first one that came in, an order for 6 books, COD. There was great jubilation that morning. Naturally, we thought we were in. We simmered down to as close to gloom as I ever remember. We got in the next few days, over the few replies, and were really practically squashed flat when the package of 6 books was returned marked, "No such address." I'm afraid none of us appreciated for a while the humor of whoever that joker was. By this time, we were at the Vesey Street office, and that address was a compromise, too. Since I lived in New Jersey, I didn't want to work in New York at all. On the other hand, you had always wanted to have the office near Grand Central Station. So we settled on Vesey Street for quite a while, about a year at least. There were just the two of us handling correspondence, packing books, and whatever there was to be done. And all the while, the financial struggle to keep the thing going at all continued. The Liberty Magazine article was published, and for the first time we began to find a stirred-up interest in the form of letters. Each letter was answered individually, and although the book was mentioned, we tried to get across the fact that it was not necessary to purchase the book, and in each case, the individual was referred to whatever group or individual AA closest to him or her. Since at that time, I imagine there were no more than 500 AA members, if that, scattered from coast to coast, and the great majority of those in the Middle West and East, it was often difficult to get any closer to the individual than several hundred miles. However, we did the best we could, and we soon fortunately began to be able to count several traveling salesmen among our AA members. Outstanding among these was Greenberg, who often made side trips of several hundred miles to try and contact people who had written to our AA office for help. When the Saturday Evening Post article hit the stands, we really began to be flooded with mail. And meanwhile, the book sales had been steadily increasing, from 2 or 3 a week until I think they hit an average of about 25 a week. And we began to be able to meet office expenses. We then had to hire an assistant who turned out to be Lorraine, who was promptly christened Sweetie Pie by you, Bill, and I don't think was ever called anything else by anyone connected with AA. I would like to say that Sweetie Pie was always cheerful and loyal and understanding beyond her years, and was a real asset to those early days of the AA office at Vesey Street. To me, some of these things that stand out most were letters from individuals who were too far distant to contact any AA group or member, but who kept writing back to us, and with the help of the book, were able to reach sobriety by themselves, and even to start their own groups. To keep us humble and laughing were developments like the Southern group started via mail through, was his last name Henry? Anyway, he wrote us flowing reports about his group and its amazing recoveries of members of his group. One of our traveling members stopped in for a visit, and his letter to us was an eye-opener indeed. It seems that this particular group was based on the theory that all alcoholic beverages were very bad for the alcoholic, except beer. This idea was carried out so thoroughly that beer was served at their AA meetings, with copious readings of the AA book. Oh well, the beer itself soon cured that misconception. One of the biggest things you ever did for the solid growth of AA, in my opinion, Bill, was to set up a policy of non-interference in the development of individual groups. You set up a policy of suggestion, not direction, with which I agreed all the way, and which I always followed. An individual or a group can resent and argue an order or direction, but how much can you resent a suggestion which carries the intimation that possibly they might come up with a better answer if they work it out for themselves? In other words, if a group wrote us a description of a problem in their midst and asked for an answer, we would usually describe what another group had done under similar circumstances or suggest possibilities and put the problem squarely back in their laps. In other words, as each individual is responsible for his own sobriety, so is each group. We learned early, too, not to make predictions about who would or would not stay sober. The most impossible-looking cases so often made the grade to confound us with the miracle, while our most promising so often fell by the wayside. Do you remember the 2 young hopefuls we practically made bets on? I think they were Mac and Shepard. They contacted us about the same time, and we were specially interested because they were younger than most at the time. As I remember it, Shepard was a high-betting favorite, while poor Mac was hopeless. To our surprise, Shepard at that time had trouble almost immediately, while Mac seemed to make steady progress in sobriety. Of course, the whole situation blew up in our faces when one day Mr. Chipman promised to visit us at Vesey Street so that you could show him what wonderful progress AA was making in every way. And to top off the performance, you invited Mac to appear to prove that even very young men could achieve sobriety. That stage was all set, and you met Mr. Chipman for lunch. Meanwhile, Mac appeared at the office completely polluted for the first time in about 6 months. Unfortunately, he was so far gone that he collapsed in a coma in the big chair in your private office. I couldn't budge him, so all I could think of to do was shut the door and try to head you off. When you appeared with Mr. Chipman, though, you were talking a blue streak, complete with gestures, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise as you swept open the door to your office to reveal Mac in all his drunken glory. After the proverbial moment of stunned silence, you broke into roars of laughter, and a minute later, bless his heart, Mr. Chipman joined you. Then I relaxed, too, and all 3 of us laughed until we literally wept. When Max snapped out of this particular binge, some days later, he enjoyed it too. This ability to laugh at yourselves and to accept the puncturing of your own self-importance is one of the basic steps in AA, I believe. Of course, it makes every individual more likable and lovable, whether alcoholic or not. What little I have been able to absorb has made life much simpler for me, I know. I'm going to quit right here, Bill. If it isn't the kind of thing you want, tear it up. If there is anything I can or should add or subtract, let me know. Always the best to you, Bill. Devotedly, Ruth.